listening to a Sharesies podcast.
Kia ora, this is an audio version of Shared Lunch, Sharesies' weekly live stream conversation between experts, CEOs, and you.
Kia ora and welcome to Shared Lunch. It's brought to you by Sharesies with Business Desk. Sharesies is a wealth development platform whose purpose is to create financial empowerment for everyone. My name is Dan Brunskill. I'm the markets reporter at Business Desk. We have a special offer for Sharesies investors. If you use the promo code SHAREDLUNCH100, you get $100 off an annual subscription to Business Desk. They're usually $250, including GST, so it's a decent discount. The offer only applies to new subscribers and can only be used once per subscriber and can't be used with any other discounts. But we would love to see you. We do a lot of economic coverage. You'll learn a lot. It'll be great. Before we get started, here's some important information.
Investing involves risk. You might lose the money you start with. We recommend talking to a licensed financial advisor. We also recommend reading product disclosure documents before deciding to invest. Everything you're about to see and hear is current at the time of recording.
Also, a quick reminder, if you have any questions for our guest today, which some people already do, you can submit them through the Ask a Question button, which should be down below this broadcast. Don't put your questions in the discussion area as we will miss them. Please be kind and respectful towards our guest and your fellow viewers, otherwise we will remove you from the webinar. Today, we are joined by Dr. Mark Diesendorf. Mark teaches environmental studies at the University of New South Wales. His research and expertise include sustainable energy, energy policy, ecological economics, and renewable energy, which is what we're focused on today. Welcome to the show, Mark.
Hello, Dan. Glad to join you.
It's a pleasure to have you. How's your day going?
Very well, thanks. It's raining outside and overcast, but my solar system is going fine.
Interesting. So you're still getting solar power despite the rain?
Oh, yes. It's well below the maximum, but enough to power this household.
That's great. Okay, so the future of renewable energy, or the future of energy in general, what is it? Is it fossil fuels? Is it coal? Is it renewable? What's the future of energy for our world?
The future is renewable energy used efficiently. We now have, particularly the solar and wind technologies, are now much cheaper than new fossil fuel electricity. So wind and solar farms are already way ahead. Rooftop solar in Australia is much cheaper than buying electricity from the grid, although it becomes more expensive in my case because I bought a battery as well.
Okay. So in your view, renewable energy, there's not a whole lot of debate around that. Renewable energy is the future, and it's just a question of how long the transition takes.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
And the key technologies that we'll be using is solar and wind power?
That's correct. Solar photovoltaic power, which has no moving parts apart from the electrons, and wind power. And the future, as I see it, will emerge in small, medium, and large scales. Small-scale household solar is very big in Australia. Nearly a quarter of our households have solar electricity on their roofs, and many have solar hot water. Utility-scale solar farms and wind farms are playing a very important role already. In the state of South Australia, they're providing more than 60% of annual electricity already, and South Australia has no hydroelectricity. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, I mean, these are the technologies of the present. And in fact, on the global scale, if we look at global investment, 3/4 of annual investment in new electricity generation is now in renewable energy, and almost all of that is in wind and solar. Mm-hmm. For comparison, maybe 3 or 4% is in nuclear, and okay, the rest is in fossil fuels.
Yeah. So that's interesting. So by far the bulk of new investment is going into those renewable technologies. How much of current, Earth's energy needs, maybe start with Australia. How much of Australia is powered by renewables, and how much of the Earth is powered by renewables?
Most of the growth of renewables has been in electricity generation. So we're just seeing the beginning of electric vehicle transport, and we haven't really begun to convert combustion heating to electric heating via heat pumps. But in terms of electricity generation, renewables in Australia are about a third, nearly a third of our electricity generation, mostly in South Australia and Tasmania, but rapidly growing in the states of New South Wales and Victoria.
So it currently makes up a third of electricity generation, but we're also moving more energy forms into electricity, namely heating. Instead of using gas, people are going to use heat pumps. Cars, instead of using fossil fuels, they're going to use electric cars. So if you guys are one third renewable, how much of that, do you have any idea sort of how much more load that will put on the system when we are driving electric cars and everyone does have heat pumps?
Well, initially we're looking at maybe a 20% increase in demand, but because Australia has such enormous renewable energy potential, we are looking at exporting it. And so South Australia, which is currently generating over 60% of its annual electricity from the wind and the sun, is planning to go to generating five times its annual electricity from renewables. And part of that excess electricity is planned to go into producing green hydrogen.
Okay.
And there are plans also for our Northern Territory, which is the nearest to Asia, to build an enormous solar farm that will transmit power across to Singapore via Indonesia through an underwater transmission line. And we have two billionaires in Australia who are putting huge resources into developing this project as well. So solar and wind will be exported both by power line and in the form of either green hydrogen or probably green ammonia, which is easier to handle.
Okay, so it seems like Australia's capability to generate renewable energy is well beyond the needs of the population in terms of consumption. Is that right, once the infrastructure is built?
Absolutely. And of course, New Zealand, Aotearoa, has huge wind potential in the South Island, that, as I understand it, the main problem is most of the population is in the North Island. And so there's a question of building the transmission link from south to north. And I, perhaps I could add, transmission is a big issue, and it's one of the main barriers, one of the main technical barriers to the more rapid expansion of renewables, large-scale renewables, in Australia and in Europe. Europe needs a north-south major transmission link. Mm-hmm. Also in the United States, the state with the most wind is Texas, but its transmission system is poorly connected to the rest of the USA. And in Australia, we desperately need new transmission links, which some of which are under development, for example, to join South Australia directly to New South Wales.
Hmm. So why is it harder to build transmission lines? It strikes me that it would be harder to build a wind farm or a solar farm rather than a line to carry the electricity. Is there a reason why that is the hang-up in some areas, like
yes,
New Zealand?
Yes, I mean, you can plan and build a large wind farm or solar farm in under 3 years, mm-hmm. and the actual construction can be done often in 6 months. With the transmission lines, one of the most time-consuming parts for a new transmission line is getting the land, getting the easement for the transmission to cross the land. Now, for an existing transmission line, it's sometimes relatively straightforward to upgrade that line to carry more capacity, and that's certainly happening slowly in Australia. For some reason, the powers that be didn't realise that it can take three times as long to build a major new transmission line than to build a whole lot of wind and solar farms.
Mm-hmm. Right. And you've got to get these things timed right, because nobody wants to put the money into building a huge solar farm if they can't then get their electricity to any buyers.
That's right. And the old coal-fired power stations in Australia had it easy because the transmission lines were paid for by including the cost in the electricity prices for the consumers. But nowadays, solar and wind farms don't have that advantage. They actually have to pay for their own transmission lines to join to the main grid. And for the major interstate transmission links, then we're looking at a combination of state and federal government funding. Mm-hmm. But as you probably now know, our current federal government is not friendly towards renewable energy. Mm.
I wanted to ask you about that, because obviously if there's such a huge opportunity for renewables in Australia, why does your government love fossil fuels so much?
Well, they have been captured by the fossil fuel industry. And by captured, I mean totally in many ways. So, for example, huge political donations go to both major political parties, mm-hmm. the Coalition and Labor. Both major political parties, when in government, get the so-called benefits of revolving jobs, which means that when a minister or a ministerial advisor retires, they often have a very lucrative job waiting for them in the industry that previously they were supposed to be managing. And similarly, some of the chief political advisors to our ministers come from the fossil fuel industry. So, for example, the chief of staff of our present prime minister comes directly from the Minerals Council of Australia. And so this is one of the issues that is now becoming public very seriously in a move to improve democracy in Australia, to weaken the influence of vested interests like the fossil fuel industry, which is currently so powerful in this country.
Mm, interesting, because it almost sounds to me like the economics of renewable energy really stack up and are winning in places like South Australia, and sort of if things are not heading in that direction, perhaps there are incentives there that are not economic.
That's right. The main barriers to a more rapid expansion of renewable energy in Australia and in the United States and other parts of the world is the political power of the fossil fuel industry. Mm-hmm. I mean, most of the technical and economic issues are trivial in comparison.
Okay, interesting. And Australia is what, 10 days, 9 days out from an election? Will the outcome of that election have any sway over the investments in renewable energy? Would it have much effect one way or another, or not particularly?
It'll have some effect, because the Labor opposition is promising to put quite a lot of money into new transmission connections, which, as I mentioned, is so important. So that will be a step forward. But nevertheless, they too are experiencing huge political donations from fossil fuel industries. They are also subject to revolving door appointments. But at least also the Labor opposition, if it gets into government, will institute a federal integrity commission. We have integrity commissions in the states, but not in the Commonwealth. And mm-hmm. that's very important for scrutinising the links between decision makers in government and industry influences. Mm.
It is interesting. A lot of renewable energy companies had a huge sort of share price boost on the market after Joe Biden was elected, because of all the talk about the Green New Deal and all the green infrastructure investment he was going to do. But most of that has not eventuated, and maybe it still will, and who's to say whether those investments were a good idea or a bad idea. But it is interesting, the talk doesn't always line up with the action, particularly with things like the Ukraine crisis. It does seem like Biden has backed off some of those clean energy goals and sort of focusing more on energy security, which for the states sometimes means fracking, sometimes means oil. If you look at what is happening with Ukraine and with oil prices and gas prices, how do you think that's going to impact the transition? Is that going to speed it up? Is it going to slow it down? What do you think the impact there is going to be?
Well, in the very short term, European countries will be desperate to get some more oil and gas. There's no doubt about that. But at the same time, clear decisions are being made that they cannot remain dependent upon Russian oil and gas. Mm-hmm. And they've already stated very clearly that they're going to phase out imports of Russian oil. Gas is more difficult, but at least right now they're moving into summer. Mm-hmm. And so the gas demand will go down. And there's no doubt that this will give a big boost to renewable energy development in Europe, so that they can have more renewable electricity, and that electricity will then provide the motive power for electric vehicles and increasingly for heating as a substitute for combustion heating.
Right. So even though in the short term there may not be any less consumption, there may in fact be more consumption of fossil fuels, you think it will hasten the transition because countries like Germany will seek to replace their Russian gas lines with self-managed renewables?
Absolutely. I mean, they've made it clear they don't want to be held to ransom by Russia. And this is also a strong weapon, if I can use that word, for controlling potential Russian incursions into Europe, further into Europe. So there's no doubt that in the medium term, renewable energy is going to grow even faster in Europe than it is at present. Of course, right now, because of the Ukraine war and also because of the rapid attempts to recover from the pandemic, we are seeing increased prices for raw materials.
Yeah.
And so the costs of some of the technologies, the costs of just about everything, are going up temporarily. But one hopes that that's going to be fairly short-lived.
In terms of the renewable energy development in Europe and Germany, and I guess in Australia as well, who is mostly doing this? Who is funding this? Is this existing energy companies that used to build fossil fuel stuff and now they're building renewable stuff? Is it new companies? Is it governments? Who's doing all this building? Who's funding it?
Well, most of it is private, actually, because renewables are now so economic compared with the old fossil fuel stations. In fact, the economics of some wind and solar farms in some areas are now so good that they are displacing existing coal-fired power stations. In fact, this is exactly what's happened in South Australia. We used to have coal-fired power as well as gas in South Australia, and the very low cost of wind, particularly, has resulted in the closure of all coal-fired power stations in South Australia. There's still quite significant generation from natural gas, but both major political parties in South Australia have indicated that they expect to reach 100% renewable electricity in South Australia by 2030.
Wow.
And they're well on the way. The economics are just so good. And it's very hard for even a relatively new coal-fired power station to compete with cheap solar and wind, because solar and wind have no fuel price. So in an electricity market, they can bid in close to zero and so displace the operation of coal. And coal-fired power stations are not designed to be switched on and off rapidly. And that's the same with nuclear, by the way. These are baseload stations. They run best if they run continuously at full power. And when you've got solar and wind basically, solar during the daytime, basically cutting them out, that destroys the economics of the baseload fossil fuel stations. And they can't last in the long run.
We had this problem not so long ago in New Zealand. Our regulator miscalculated how much electricity we needed one cold night, and they didn't turn on our coal-fired plant. And then when they realized they didn't have enough electricity, it just took too long to turn it on. And then by the time demand had come down, the energy company no longer wanted to turn it on because it would cost them money to do so. There's some real downsides beyond the environmental impact of some of these technologies, some of these old technologies, I should say. We'll jump into questions soon, but I was interested to know about how when we want to get as much renewable energy going as possible. It's relatively easy when it's installing a heat pump or switching to an electric car. What about things like air travel and freight shipping? Are we ever going to be able to make them into renewable forms, or will there always be some sort of emissions associated with that? What's the state of play there?
Well, the state of play is research and development mainly. The future vision is to run them on a fuel produced from green hydrogen, that is hydrogen produced by using renewable electricity to split water or renewable heat to split water to obtain hydrogen, and then to get a more manageable fuel, perhaps to combine hydrogen with nitrogen in the atmosphere to form ammonia, which is much more manageable. Mm-hmm. So that's the main pathway for long-distance air and sea transport, and that's an area that does require much more R&D. Producing green hydrogen is very inefficient in energy terms,
okay,
and that means it's still very expensive.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of confidence now amongst major investors, billionaire investors, that the price of green hydrogen is going to come down quite rapidly over this decade, and big investments are already being made. So this is an exciting area, but it definitely will need improvements resulting from research and development, as well as an expansion of the market to bring that price down to a level where it can compete with hydrogen produced from fossil fuels.
Right. Okay. So that's one area where there's still some progress needing to be made before it can take over, before we have our Air New Zealand hydrogen flights. I guess the other thing that I was interested in asking you about is, there's a lot of the pushback against renewables is that you hear from, particularly from politicians, is what do you do when it's raining and there's no wind, or when the sun doesn't shine and the wind doesn't blow, what do you do? And what's the answer to that question? Is it batteries? Do we just have to have some coal on hand for those unlucky days? What's the sort of strategy there?
Well, it's a combination of measures. First, you have a mix of different renewable energy sources. So when the sun isn't shining, very often the wind is indeed blowing. Mm-hmm. And then you have not only a mix of sources, but a mix of locations. So if the sun isn't shining or the wind isn't blowing in one location, if you have power coming in from a location in a different time zone, for example, then you can still smooth across that area. Now, for short-term storage, there's no doubt batteries are the way to go, and big batteries are being installed at a very high rate in Australia now, and they are now pretty well economic for storage of just a few hours. That is storage throughout the peaks in demand. And there's no doubt for short-term storage, batteries are the way to go. But if we want to store overnight or for several days, and we do sometimes have lulls in the wind for several days, then we need other forms of storage. And one of the areas under development in Australia, or I should say under further development, is pumped hydro. Pumped hydro is, of course, the main form of storage around the world for large-scale electricity generation. But what's new in this area is that in a very dry country like Australia, the emphasis has been on devising hydroelectricity, pumped hydroelectricity, that does not need rivers. So basically, the principle is the same. You have two reservoirs, and when you have an excess of electricity, you pump water up from the bottom to the top reservoir. And when demand is high or supply of renewables is low, you release the water, it falls down to the lower reservoir and generates electricity.
Okay.
Now, Australia has some very interesting schemes. We have a conventional pumped hydro scheme being added to the Snowy Mountains scheme. But what's more interesting is the off-river pumped hydro. Mm-hmm. And the first of these, which is now being built, is using a disused mine where there are already two reservoirs and the water can be pumped between them. We don't need a river, we just need an initial charge of water. And then if all goes to plan, any evaporation will be balanced by occasional rainfall. So this is a disused mine in Queensland. And there are many other proposals for pumped hydro, for example, pumping from seawater up a cliff to a reservoir, a small reservoir on top of the cliff, and using that.
You continue.
Okay, so this is Australia. We don't really need seasonal storage, or we don't need additional seasonal storage in Australia. Mm-hmm. Europe is a different story, of course. Much greater difference between summer and winter.
Long, dark winters.
Absolutely. And so Europe is looking at what they call power to X, where excess power, when they have excess power, will go into either producing green hydrogen or producing green chemicals or into other forms of energy storage that can then release the electric power when needed at a later date. So power to X, and X is often green hydrogen, is under very rapid research and development in Europe. That will certainly be a need there.
Yeah.
But there are other forms of storage also, particularly if you have a natural reservoir underground. Compressed air is another way of storing energy and then releasing it when you actually need it.
Interesting.
More for the reliability. You can also, of course, manage demand. So you can reduce demand during the peaks using pricing incentives and other incentives, and so increase the reliability mm-hmm. of the electricity generating system. And mm-hmm. we have so-called virtual power plants now operating really as pilots, where hundreds of household and other solar systems and batteries are now joined together by a coordinating business, which can then bid into the grid either to absorb electricity when there's an excess or to feed its own electricity into the grid when needed. So there are many exciting developments that can ensure that we can have a reliable electricity system with 100% renewables.
Yeah. Okay, interesting. And it's not like fossil fuels have necessarily always been 100% reliable anyway. I think we've got lots of good questions, Mark. So we might jump into those listener questions. Starting with, somebody did just ask, what is green hydrogen? And I did wonder if you could do a breakdown on you did go into it a little bit. Maybe you could just quickly go over it again. What is hydrogen? What is green? Why do we call it green hydrogen versus blue hydrogen or other types of hydrogen?
So hydrogen is produced usually by splitting water into hydrogen and oxygen. And traditionally, it's been done by using fossil fuels, or natural gas, for example, which, of course, emits greenhouse gas emissions. So that's blue or brown hydrogen, depending on how you do it. Green hydrogen is using renewable electricity to split water. That's the main difference. And renewable electricity is going to get a lot cheaper, but the challenge is to increase the efficiency of the splitting process, which is called electrolysis, and to bring down the cost.
Okay. And forgive me for my high school level science, but once you put that hydrogen in a vehicle, how does it then power the vehicle?
Well, you can either, the most efficient way is to use what's called a fuel cell, mm-hmm. which chemically combines it with oxygen to produce water again and releasing energy at the same time. So the initial energy that was taken out gets released. But, of course, you can also burn hydrogen. It's less efficient. Okay. You can burn it in various ways, in a diesel engine modified or a gas turbine modified. So you could, in theory, power an aircraft engine, a jet engine, with green hydrogen with some modification. A jet engine is just a gas turbine, open-cycle gas turbine.
Yeah. So and that burning process doesn't emit anything bad?
It doesn't produce carbon emissions. It just produces water, mm-hmm. although if you don't do it carefully, you might get some nitrogen oxides as well.
Okay. Right. Interesting. Okay, so literal water-powered cars. That's great.
Yes.
Can I jump to some questions? I'm not sure how much you know about the New Zealand power market itself, but we'll throw you this question and you can just do what you can with it. Tim asks, I'm interested to hear your thoughts on green hydrogen production. Two energy suppliers here in New Zealand, Contact and Meridian, are both seeking registrations of interest to develop the world's largest green hydrogen plant. Do you see hydrogen overtaking lithium or just being another arrow in the green energy quiver?
Okay, I don't think lithium will be overtaken for car batteries unless mm-hmm. it's another battery like well, there are various batteries under development of different chemistries than lithium. Now, hydrogen's value is, as we discussed previously, first and foremost for long-distance aviation and shipping. Short-distance aviation, I think we'll see battery-powered aircraft in the near future. We're already seeing small ones. Mm-hmm. The other main use of hydrogen, green hydrogen, is in industrial processes like steel making and aluminium making. And in this case, the hydrogen isn't an energy source, but it's a chemical. For example, in the case of steel making, hydrogen can be used instead of coal to reduce iron ore to iron. And so hydrogen, and particularly green hydrogen, is going to be very important in the industrial area. Now, in New Zealand, as we mentioned, most of the wind power potential is actually on the South Island. Mm-hmm. So I'm interested in where the location of these proposed green hydrogen plants is going to be, whether it's going to be in the South Island, because your South Island has enormous undeveloped wind potential on the Canterbury Plains, for example. Mm-hmm. And we've known that for several decades. But there hasn't been the motivation until now to develop that wind potential because most of the population and industry is, of course, in the North Island.
So you could develop that wind opportunity without the transmission line and just set up a hydrogen plant and then export that hydrogen.
That's great. Yeah.
Okay, but it won't overtake lithium, not in everyday batteries at least.
I don't think so, and I really don't see much of a role for hydrogen in motor vehicles at all, to be honest. Mm. On land-based motor vehicles. I think batteries are already there and they're going to get a lot cheaper. There may be, in future, a mix of different chemistries of batteries, and that's okay, that's good. Lithium, at present, most of the lithium is produced by China, but Australia has enormous reserves of lithium, and at last there is talk of developing those reserves and possibly even creating a battery industry in Australia.
Right.
Of course, there's been the traditional view in Australia that we are just a quarry for the rest of the world, and our manufacturing industry has been allowed or even encouraged to decline. And that's a shame, and perhaps that will change, and perhaps there will be a recovery because we have the raw materials and there are a lot of people keen to get into adding value.
So we could see Australian-made batteries.
That's right.
I'd like that. Next question from Corey says, despite negative sentiment, nuclear energy is statistically one of the safest, most carbon-efficient and scalable ways to reach net zero. Where do you see nuclear fitting into the wider energy landscape?
Okay. Well, there have been various studies for a start on the economics of nuclear today. And these are studies by groups that don't have a vested interest. So, for example, Lazard is a multinational financial advice organization. According to Lazard, wind and solar electricity are one quarter to one fifth the cost of electricity from new nuclear now.
Okay.
Similar results from Australia's CSIRO, our national research organization, and they have also added storage into the economics. And even with storage added, wind and solar are now cheaper than nuclear. Mm-hmm. Nuclear also is an extremely slow technology to build. We're facing a climate crisis. By the time Australia, for example, could have its first nuclear power station, we could be almost 100% renewable electricity at a fraction of the cost.
Yeah. So it's slower and it's more expensive.
And it's much more dangerous, of course.
Yeah. Is part of the reason why it is so expensive because it is so dangerous and you have to build incredibly secure plants. Is that partly why it costs so much?
Well, not really, because there's just such huge subsidies to nuclear power in every country where it's been built. It's never stood on its own as a commercial operation. And if you just look at the current situation in the United Kingdom with their new nuclear power station under construction, the government has guaranteed a price for that nuclear electricity, which is much greater than the wholesale price of electricity now. It's guaranteed it for something like 30 years and increasing with inflation. I mean, and if you look around the world, where we can get the data from the United States and from Europe and so on, the subsidies are enormous. Nuclear is claimed to be cheap in Russia and China, but we can't get the data to confirm that.
Right, right. Okay, so not no nuclear for you.
Not really.
I learned to my surprise recently that New Zealand actually had plans to build nuclear power plants in the 70s and the 80s. And the only reason they didn't is that they found the Maui oil and gas field and they decided that would be enough energy and they never bothered to build a nuclear power plant. So we, just before that whole nuclear-free moment that cemented New Zealand as this anti-nuclear country, we were about to build a huge nuclear power plant.
Could I add that in the 1960s, Australia planned to build a nuclear power station that we now know its main purpose was to produce plutonium for nuclear weapons.
Oh, wow.
Fortunately, that project was terminated at a very early stage due to a change in the Prime Minister and, we think, pressure from the United States. But nuclear weapons proliferation is a very real risk of nuclear power. And nuclear power provides a cloak for proliferation of nuclear weapons.
Yeah, and we do not want that for obvious reasons. Here's another question from Rachel. In relation to how we use energy now and the carbon footprint it creates, let me rework this question. How does the carbon footprint for production and disposal? Okay, so she's asking, how does the carbon footprint of producing and disposing of batteries compare to the carbon footprint of using the sort of current status quo energy, burning coal and natural gas?
Well, there's no doubt that the getting the raw materials and building the new technologies will use energy. Mm-hmm. And initially, part of that energy is going to be fossil energy. But as time goes on, it'll become more and more renewable. So we have a situation in Australia now where there's a rapid move among mining companies in remote areas to go solar. So we have mining companies and mineral processing companies, at least for their electricity, are actually building their own wind farms.
Wow.
And solar farms.
Mm-hmm.
And because it's cheaper. So in the long run, we'll be making wind and solar and batteries, renewable energy sources, essentially, with renewable energy inputs.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way we're already moving quite rapidly. And, you know, hundreds of large corporations even now have committed to transitioning to 100% renewable energy, whether they do that partly by installing their own wind and solar or mainly by purchasing new and existing wind and solar farms. Mm-hmm. It's already happening. And so we are going to get a full industry cycle, a full supply chain, which eventually is going to be totally renewable.
Right. So, but you're confident that during the transition, we won't produce more carbon emissions, do more environmental damage than we would have if we did not transition? Like, is the transition itself going to have a carbon cost associated, I guess?
It will have a carbon cost initially, and as time goes on, that carbon cost will shrink, and eventually it'll shrink to zero when we're producing renewable energy using renewable energy. And really, we have great advantages with wind and solar because a solar module generates the energy required to build it in 1 to 2 years. And a wind farm or a wind turbine in a windy location generates the energy required to build itself in 3 to 6 months. And these technologies will have lifetimes of at least 25 years. So although there is an initial energy investment, and initially it will be at least partly fossil fuels, it will repay in energy terms many times over that initial energy investment, and eventually there'll be no carbon investment. That's that's the way things are going.
Mm-hmm. Okay, interesting. We should have gone to questions sooner because there's so many good ones. Here's another one. It's saying, we understand renewables are the way to go, but what are your thoughts on being self-sufficient, i.e. having your own on-house, on-farm energy sources, windmills, solar plant, and kind of being off the grid? What's the thoughts on that versus making everything centralized and mass-produced?
Well, I'm totally for it for those who want to do that, but some of us like living in cities. And the problem is really, it's fine if a minority of people develop their own earth gardens. That's terrific, and become independent. But if everyone does it, the environmental impacts would be enormous. So instead of trying to compact human population in cities, we would be spread out all through nature, cutting down forests, really drawing upon much more resources than we do now, where people are at least partly concentrated into cities. So it's not quite so simple. I think in the future, the future civilization that I see will have a mix of dense, compact cities with excellent public transport and active transport, walking and cycling, all those facilities concentrated for people who want it and need it. And it'll also have a mix of people who decide to build their own self-sufficient homes or communities outside the cities, or even within the cities, it may be possible.
Yes.
So that's the possibility. Mm-hmm. But right now, we're heading for not such a pleasant future unless we move very quickly to deal with the major crises that we're facing, the climate crisis, the loss of biological diversity, the loss of our soils, the destruction of our forests, the pollution and loss of fresh water. I mean, it goes on and on. Yeah. We're facing all these crises. So we need to actually move very strongly and firmly to try and create a much more sustainable future.
Yeah. Yeah. I reckon we try to sneak in one more question because there's an interesting one here that I want to know the answer to. Alex says, I've heard a lot of energy is lost converting renewable energy from DC to AC current. Is that true? And should we revert back to DC appliances and lines to save energy?
Well, if you just have a small self-sufficient house, you might as well work with DC entirely. But if you need to transmit power, really going to AC, it has enormous advantages.
Okay.
The irony is that if you want to transmit over very long distances, like from Darwin to Singapore, you need to convert to DC for the long distance stretch, and then you need to convert back to AC at the other end.
Yeah.
So there are some losses involved, but they're not enormous. But the cost of the converter stations at each end is quite high.
Okay. Mark, this has been fascinating. We should almost do a sequel based on the level of interest in this. But thank you so much for coming and chatting, and thanks to everyone for tuning in. We really appreciate getting to hear from you and get your insights. So thank you so much.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Pleasure. Next week on Shared Lunch, my colleague Francis Cook is going to be chatting with Leonard Sampson, who's the chief executive of the Port of Tauranga. So do come back and tune into that. There's a link to register for that in the chat right now, so you can get a little notification and come back and join us. Yeah, that's all. Enjoy the rest of your week and stay safe. May it be renewable.
For more info, visit sharesies.co.nz or look us up on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter.